this was a hallmark of the Bush administration. They just didn't seem to care about those offshore resources, whether it was polar bears or whales.
A court strikes down the Bush administration's offshore drilling plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 17th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the recession is taking a big bite out of the Alaska tourism industry.
We were down 72% from last year at this time in terms of bookings.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
A federal appeals court today put a stop to the Bush administration's offshore lease plan that would have allowed oil and gas exploration and development over millions of acres of the Outer Continental Shelf, or OCS, area of the Chukchi, Beaufort, and Bering Seas. The unanimous legal opinion from the three-judge panel effectively halts all upcoming leases in the Bristol Bay area, as well as the Gulf of Mexico and areas of the Atlantic Ocean off Virginia's coast. The Chukchi sale that was held in February of 2008 in Anchorage, bids brought in nearly $2.7 billion, the most of any offshore sale in Alaska history. Shell Alaska totaled the highest in bids at $2.1 billion. A Shell spokesman declined to talk about what this may mean for the future of their lease plans in the Arctic, saying they were reviewing the decision and it was premature to comment. Peter Van Tine is the Anchorage attorney who argued the case for the people who brought the suit, the Native Village of Point Hope, the Alaska Wilderness League, and Pacific Environment. Van Tine says the law requires that a balance between impacting the ecosystem against the amount of oil that could be retrieved has to be struck. He says the Bush administration did not do that. He called their analysis irrational.
That's a really important thing for the new administration to look at. And what we can say with certainty is that Secretary Salazar is no Secretary Kempthorne, who was the Bush inferior person and who made this decision that was overturned. And, you know, Salazar has already said, look, we're going to review the Bush decisions based on science and policy because they just seem out of whack. And this opinion gives him legal justification to do exactly what he's doing.
Van Tine says the Bush administration did not look at the extreme diversity of the Arctic ecosystem in ice-dominated waters when they gauged environmental sensitivity.
For a coast that is at the closest 3 miles away and could be as far as 200 miles away to say, well, it's just the sensitivity of the coast that matters. This was a hallmark of the Bush administration. They just didn't seem to care about those offshore resources, whether it was polar bears or whales or seals or walrus. Those kind of things always got shunted to the back of the line for them. And, you know, Salazar has said that's not going to be the case anymore. We're going to make our decisions based on science.
Caroline Cannon is Point Hope's village president. She says residents made numerous trips to Washington, D.C. to testify on behalf of the Inupiaq people who worried that offshore development would destroy their subsistence way of life. She says this morning's news was a pleasant surprise.
Yes, I wasn't prepared for it. You know, we're getting ready for whaling, and I was hoping this would come to this point, and I just was really excited that, you know, to wake up like this was a heartfelt, answered prayer. We've been praying for a long time, and it was just wonderful.
Officials with the Minerals Management Service who created the lease plan and held the sale did not make themselves available for comment today. It remains unclear whether the billions of dollars in bids will have to be paid back to Shell and the other companies or whether MMS will challenge the decision. Alaska tourism businesses are bracing for a rough season. With startup about a month out, it's clear that the recession will have a big impact on visitor numbers. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Most people don't come to Alaska on a whim. An Alaska Travel Industry Association president and chief operating officer Ron Peck says that makes the state's tourism operators especially vulnerable to the drawn-out economic slowdown.
Because we're a long-haul destination, we're being impacted even more harshly than some other states might be. We have heard from businesses from Ketchikan to Tok and everywhere in between pretty challenging stories. Businesses are down 20, 30, upwards, some of them even over 50% in terms of their advance bookings.
Peck spoke to a group of tourism business operators from along the parks and Richardson highways gathered for a conference in Fairbanks. He says the worst may be yet to come, given cruise ship companies' planned cancellation of some Alaska sailings in 2010 and beyond. The loss of about 100,000 of the over 1 million passengers that come to Alaska via cruise lines annually will likely compound what's already a rough situation for businesses that provide shore-based activities and side trips. Scott Reisland, who runs Denali Grizzly Bear Resort on the park's highway, says this has been the worst preseason in his family's 41 years of business.
I just completed my first quarter fiscal statements and taxes, and we were down 72% from last year at this time in terms of bookings. And that's a really scary thing for us.
Reisland says he currently has 40 to 50 rooms empty per day for the upcoming summer at a time when he's normally all booked up. He says he knows he's not alone in the situation.
People aren't traveling to Alaska. I mean, you're seeing this impact in the cruise ship industry. Airlines are canceling flights that they normally have seasonally coming to the state. They're moving boats from Whittier, the cruise ships, out to the Caribbean. It's going to be really tough.
Reisland says he's reduced rates and is hoping Alaskans choosing to travel in-state can shore up business. That sentiment is echoed by Colleen Stevens, who runs Stan Stevens Cruises in Valdez and serves on the ATIA Marketing Committee. Stevens says the statewide decline in preseason bookings is worse than the one that followed the 2001 terrorist attacks. And she says not only business owners are being hurt.
Our shorter tour is running 7 days a week, but our longer tour is only going to be running about four, which means, you know, our onboard crew are going from, you know, 15 to nine. And so it does equate to jobs. And you'll see that across the board in the state. There's a fishing lodge that we've been told about in Kenai that normally hires 14, and they've hired two.
Stevens says a statewide effort is underway to boost business. The ATIA's PEC says the hottest deals from the coolest state program has about 200 operators offering a range of special deals.
Everything from dollars off, stay two nights, get third night free, special package programs with other businesses that they can align themselves with. And so we're pleased with the number of people that are participating. But at the same moment, there's a little bit of a sadness in that just because that's an indicator that businesses are hurting.
Peck says one bright spot in the upcoming season may be in the hard-to-predict road travel market. He says lower fuel prices may mean more people driving to and around Alaska this summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rural residents work to build an antitrust case against a company that delivers fuel.
Crowley has us where they want us. There is no competition here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The legislature is still on track to adjourn by Sunday night, and as the House and Senate go into the final weekend of work, members are either involved in intense negotiations over a few remaining issues, or they're sitting around waiting for committees and session. APRN's Dave Donaldson is at the Capitol in Juneau. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Dave, has work on most of the essential bills been finished?
Yeah, most of them. A compromise on the House and Senate versions of the operating budget has been approved by both sides. They agree it was pretty much hold the course budget without any radical changes and didn't get a lot of attention. There's one issue with using the budget reserve for funding education, but I still can't see that as beyond simply an accounting question. And it's being covered with the capital budget that's still circulating, so it's not a huge problem. the bills of spending the federal economic stimulus money are done. And, you know, it was interesting to note that the House was unanimous in taking the money and only a few minority Republicans opposed it. But that's also finished.
You mentioned the capital budget. Is there a problem with it or is this routine?
Well, it's always the last minute bill that everything gets thrown into. So it's kind of routine in that way. And there's nothing deadly going on that I see. You know, they kind of had a hiccup last night when an entry appeared in the House version, basically funding the governor's top priority, the beginnings of in-state gas line. And the problem came up with a description of that project that was basically what NSTAR had proposed. They got a little bit tied up and a little bit angry at each other over that, between the administration and with the House and with the Senate, and everybody was a little bit, you know, they went home and slept it out. Basically, the plan they came back with today is to take it out of the budget, put it into a Senate bill, and make it more or less route neutral and not making it something that NSTAR is the only person qualified for it. Yeah, there's not any other holdups, at least nothing that I've found yet. They can be fixed by Sunday.
There have been a lot of other bills, too. Are some of those looking like they're settled?
Some of them are. From those that I've been asked about, seem to be pretty high on people's priorities. The power cost equalization bill, it's the one that keeps the formula and the ceiling and floor of the program at the temporary levels that they were set at last year. It's what they are right now. Just doesn't make any changes because all those temporary measures were supposed to go away at the end of June. Anyhow, the bill just needs one vote on the House floor now before it goes to the governor, and I don't see any problem with that coming from anybody. It's been pretty much unanimous along the way here. That'll take care of that one. The cruise ship discharge bill needs just one more vote, and all the problems there seem to have been massaged out. The two key points are that the Department of Environmental Conservation will issue waivers for discharge standards, but there's a time limit. And only for 5 years when the law gets tough. Right, you know, this two-step increase in the minimum wage is also ready for a House vote anytime now. Those look pretty good right now.
Seems like there's going to be a lot for you to watch this weekend.
You know, it's actually beginning to focus, but we'll see by Monday.
All right, Dave, thanks for that update.
Bye.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. The city of Bethel is asking the state's attorney general's office to look for antitrust violations in Western Alaska. The Bethel City Council is concerned that there is a lack of competition in the delivered fuel market. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
The Bethel City Council is unanimously requesting that the Attorney General's office look into the operations of the Crowley Fuel Company. Councilmember Lamont Albertson.
Crowley has us where they want us. There is no competition here.
There are just two companies that deliver fuel to much of Western Alaska, Crowley and Delta Western. Delta Western joined the delivery market in 2004. Their entry was part of a consent decree drafted by the Attorney General's office under Greg Renkes. At that time, Crowley was offering to buy up another competitor, Yukon Fuel. The state said a wholesale buyout would have provided Crowley with a monopoly, which is a violation of the state's antitrust laws. Instead, they worked out a deal. Crowley was allowed to buy out Yukon, but in exchange, they had to sell two barge and tug sets to Delta Western. They also had to provide Delta Western with 30% of their fuel storage space in Bethel and allow storage access to any competitors in Nome, Kotzebue, and St. Michael. The Attorney General's office said that the decree would benefit Western Alaska by allowing for competition. Now, 5 years later, the Bethel City Council is doubting that's the case. Vice Mayor Dan Leinberger says their concern is about more than just high fuel prices.
The crux at hand is, do we still have a competitive market?
At the urging of Bethel and other communities in Western Alaska, the House Judiciary Committee has already held hearings on the issue. Committee co-chair and Republican Jay Ramirez says the state is failing Western Alaska.
There is no entity that provides specific oversight, and I personally find that to be a glaring deficiency.
Democrat Bob Herron is Bethel's representative. He says many in his district are concerned that Crowley and Delta Western aren't really trying to compete for business.
I don't think anybody's been is charging collusion with the suppliers out there, but I think that what people are concerned about, and that's what I read between the lines, is sort of a lazy collusion or an indifferent collusion.
Assistant Attorney Ed Sniffen also attended the committee hearings. He says prosecuting a case without direct evidence of collusion would be difficult.
Difficult from the sense that it's hard to find a violation of state law under those kinds of circumstances.
Sniffen is the main author of the consent decree. He said his office would be willing to reopen it, but he first needs to see clear signs that it's not working.
It would be helpful if folks who are submitting requests to the Attorney General to review this decree, if they could have as specific and detailed examples of where they think competition is failing.
But Bethel's Senator, Democrat Lyman Hoffman, says it's the Attorney General's office that's in the best position to find that kind of detailed and specific information. He says the state's top prosecutors could put the issue to rest.
They need to prove that there are no gouging of the citizens of the Delta.
Crowley Fuel did not make anyone available for an interview, but Marketing Director Doreen Tasaya says Crowley would welcome a review of the consent decree. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Coinciding with the latest report on sexual violence in Anchorage, various groups battling the problem gathered at a public forum this week to compare their individual efforts and challenges, including those that reach beyond the city. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Too many years at the top is a familiar expression for those battling sexual violence in Alaska. According to the latest statistics on rape presented by Carrie Longoria of Anchorage's Health and Human Services Department, the phrase remains painfully accurate.
These are preliminary figures, but right now, Fairbanks is number one and Anchorage is number four.
Those initial figures came from the FBI's 2007 Uniform Crime Report for all metropolitan statistical areas. Both the Anchorage and Fairbanks areas were above Alaska's overall rate, which itself is twice as high as the national average. Longoria had other local statistics.
For those that are 15 years of age and under, from 2006 to 2008, Alaska Cares conducted forensic medical examinations on 2,412 children for an average of 804 cases a year. I've found that amazing.
CARE stands for Alaska Child Abuse Response and Evaluation Services. The municipality's Health and Human Services Department and the Anchorage Women's Commission sponsored the forum. About two dozen Anchorage-based groups and individuals dealing with sexual violence reported on the particular problems they face. The discussions sometimes extended beyond Anchorage. Alan Bailey practices family law. Bailey serves on local and national commissions concerned with sexual and domestic violence. He cited a study concerning Athabascan women in interior Alaska, appearing in this month's issue of the journal Violence Against Women.
64% of the women in the villages studied reported being assaulted at least once in their lives, as opposed to 22% in one national study, or the commonly accepted percentage of 30% to 35%.
Bailey's reference to rural Alaska seemed appropriate to the group. It wasn't only because of the recent migration of Bush families to Anchorage. The forum participants were fully aware that some sexual violence victims from rural Alaska slip away to Anchorage seeking assistance and perhaps, according to Catherine Andrew, justice.
It's scary out there. How do I report when it's my sister-in-law who's the health aide in my community? How do I report that her brother just sexually assaulted me and I'm bleeding? How do I report it? Because she's just going to tell me to get over it. She's not supposed to, but she's going to tell me that.
Andrew works as a domestic violence program coordinator for the tribal government of St. Paul Island. She's been in the field for about 20 years. If her sister-in-law example was hypothetical, Andrew says the lack of village confidentiality, family or friendship ties to the perpetrator, even the community's protection of the perpetrator, do exist throughout rural Alaska. Those conditions, plus their physical injuries, can bring victims to Anchorage.
People that are assaulted usually get flown off of St. Paul and they come here to Anchorage. They lose their immediate support on St. Paul and they're here in Anchorage, away from family, friends. And if they want to relocate, now they've lost everything else.
Jennifer Meyer supervises the Clinical Forensic Services at Providence, Alaska Medical Center. Meyer described common, long-lasting emotional impacts from sexual violence.
Our patients are more likely to experience depression, substance abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, and suicide than their non-abused counterparts.
Meyer suggested all communities need to take a more proactive attitude towards sexual violence. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
An ugly situation at Matanuska Electric Association got a little uglier this week as utility board members prepared to fire a long-term general manager. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, mudslinging and negative allegations have marred an upcoming board election.
Earlier this week, Matanuska Electric Association's board of directors sacked two members of the management team. Assistant manager Tuckerman Babcock and IT director Bruce Scott were fired without cause. Babcock pointed to his support of candidates challenging two board incumbents up for election, but he saved the most vitriolic comments for board member Janet Kincaid in particular.
Janet Kincaid should not be using her position on the board to advantage her son's financial and personal interests.
Kincaid is not up for re-election. Board President Lois Lester and member Kit Jones are. But a bylaw change also on the ballot irks Babcock. He says sitting board members tried to block Proposition 1 from the ballot.
It would prohibit someone from being on the board whose immediate family members are involved in a $10,000-plus electrical business relationship with the MEA. And Janet Kincaid, who is on the board of directors, her son, David Kincaid, is an electrical contractor who does far in excess of that amount of money with MEA. And it has been an ongoing challenge at MEA to deal with Janet Kincaid constantly carrying the water for her son's financial interests.
Lester and Jones are urging MEA members to vote no on Prop 1. Their campaign literature states that Prop 1 is a thinly veiled attempt to remove Janet Kincaid from the board. Lois Lester.
First of all, Prop 1 would eliminate thousands of MEA members from even applying for the board. It is too restrictive. Even in a sense, if you had a cousin twice removed that had, let's say, a $10,000 contract with MEA, you could not run for the board. So it's just too restrictive.
Babcock says he personally investigated activities by David Kincaid involving the use of MEA materials and the use of MEA's warehouse. He says half an hour after giving his report to the board, he was terminated.
Believe me, Alan, there'll be no further investigation into what was going on with their son in MEA's warehouse. That'll all be swept under the rug.
Janet Kincaid, for her part, says she's sorry her family is being dragged into the turmoil. She would not go on tape for this story because she says she fears that Babcock's termination will result in a lawsuit against the board. But Kincaid did say that she is only one of seven board members and has no control over how MEA's budget is spent. She also said her son does not work for MEA, nor does he subcontract for anyone that does. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Although Mount Redoubt is not causing any flight delays currently, the volcano is still erupting, and the Alaska Volcano Observatory website says lava dome building continues. Steve McNutt is a volcanologist with the AVO in Fairbanks. McNutt says Redoubt has exhibited some spectacular examples of volcanic lightning during its recent explosive events. He says he first started tracking volcanic lightning during the Mount Spur eruption in 1992. It was showing up on the seismic monitors.
The same time that spikes were showing up on our seismic data, the BLM lightning system, which works in the summertime, recorded lightning at the exact same time. So It turns out we were actually recording more lightning on our seismic system by accident than the VLM system, which was designed to record lightning, mainly because it was far away up near Fairbanks trying to catch forest fires in the summer. Then continued with the lightning work, looking at a global survey, put together a database of all the known instances of lightning worldwide. It's up to well over 200 cases at about 77 different volcanoes. So from my point of view as a seismologist, it's in seismology, we have depth increasing downward, and in lightning, you have altitude increasing upward. And so for me, lightning is upside down seismology at the speed of light.
Is the lightning coming from inside the volcano, or does the eruption create atmospheric conditions that make the lightning happen?
What the volcano does, it shoots charged particles into the sky. And so those charged particles are rock fragments and pieces of fresh volcanic glass and gases and aerosols. Then once the particles are up in the air, the charges start to move around and separate. And it's when you get concentrated charges separated by distances of a few hundred meters to a few kilometers, that's when you start getting lightning up in the plume.
And what are you learning with this information about volcanic electricity and lightning? What does this help you know?
Well, lightning is part of the global electrical circuit. You know, there's something called a free air gradient. You may not be aware of it, but there is an electrical potential field that exists between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. So electric charges are constantly moving around, and lightning storms are one main manifestation of that. So lightnings are a component. Volcanic lightning is a component of the global electric circuit. It also tells us something about the basic physics of what happens in the plume. It's not just some benign process or a group of particles that suddenly occur or appear. When the particles are created and move around and interact with each other and bump into each other and break, those processes generate electric charges. And also the water that comes out in eruptions, there's about 4 weight percent water in magmas. The water also contributes to electric charge, and it's very much like a thunderstorm. A thunderstorm does it all with just water.
Will this information help you to better be able to predict what may happen with seismic activity in volcanoes in the future?
Because it only occurs once the eruptions are underway, it won't help with forecasting the onset of the activity or anything that happens under the ground. It will help us to better understand what happens up in the atmosphere, because before an eruption, the questions you ask are, is it going to erupt? And if so, how big is it going to be? And when, and that sort of thing. After an eruption starts, now the questions change. Is there ash produced? How high did it go? Which way is it going? Do I have to take any actions to prevent loss of life or property? So what we're finding is the amount of lightning in the plume appears to be proportional to the amount of ash. So it's giving us some additional information about how much ash is in the plume. And one of the nice features of it is it works pretty good even at night and in lousy weather when you can't make direct visual observations. We still record the lightning.
Steve McNutt is a volcanologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory in Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.